As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
To the Total Soccer Show and our latest dive into the listener questions mailbag. Today we're making North America best 11s. We're pitting Klopp against Alonso, and we're sending Jesse Marsh back to MLS. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me to A your cues, Taylor Rockwell. Hello.
I hated that, but it makes sense, so I'll let it slide. Hello, Ryan Bailey. How are you?
You don't like me abbreviating things, is that right?
AMIQ just sounds bad. It sounds dirty. I don't know what it is. But either way, it feels like a good start to this episode, which kind of feels like it's already off the rails before we even hit recording. So hey, I'm excited.
I'm just here taking the Australian influence. They abbreviate everything T. T, there we go.
Barbie and the like.
Exactly. The Sarvo this afternoon.
Sarvo?
The Sarvo. We'll go get a beer, the Sarvo, mate.
Oh, Australia. Oh, Australia.
Graham Ruffin. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ryan. I personally enjoy you shortening everything. Are you having a good, cheeky international weeky?
Was that shorter?
I hate this even more. Do you think with Australia it's because everything wants to kill you so they don't have time to communicate in full sentences? Okay, that makes more sense to me.
It's endearing, I think.
Giant spiders, sharks, the most poisonous snakes. I feel like you got to get to it pretty quick, yeah.
You do indeed. Joe Lowry, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Taylor. That was brilliant. Yeah, I do not think there is time for full sentences in Australia because there's already something bearing down your back.
They're very busy people trying to avoid constant animals trying to kill them. You're quite right. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show for our bonus content, by the way. We've got bonus episodes, we've got video content, and of course, access to the Discord where all the cool kids are hanging out. In bonus question news for this week, bonus episode news, we have a bonus question from our listeners, from Richard Olsen in particular. Richard Rolson, excuse me, goodness me. He's asking about Kevin De Bruyne coming to MLS. It's going to happen. We'll see which team.
Sexier than Oli Giroud coming?
Well, not. I mean, in some ways.
I think we've established that Giroud is handsome to men. That men think Olivier Giroud is a handsome.
Yes, I am a man.
Women less so. So, interesting one. An interesting dilemma there. I think my thought experiment was: is Mats Hummels objectively more attractive than Olivier Giroud? And based on the six people I sampled, the answer is yes.
No, the answer surely no.
Not this sample group over here, I can tell you that much. More on that on the bonus feed. And also, we've got an episode coming up on the bonus feed of Taylor's questions. It's like listeners' questions, but it's Taylor's questions he's going to ask, and we're going to put the world to rights with them.
He hasn't told us what these questions are, so yeah. I am excited / nervous.
They're a little bit deep thoughty questions. It's going to be something.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow if you would like to support our show. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you to everybody who has sent us a listener question, TotalSoccerShow.com/questions. There's another web address for you. You can submit a question there, just as Bobby Drexler has done. If you could clone the USMNT twice, then combine one USMNT roster with Canada and then one USMNT roster with Mexico, which side do you think would be better? Bobby would love to hear our best 11s and our analysis. Oh, Joe's got his he's got his shoulders are shaking. He's ready for this one. Where are you going to go with this one, Joe?
Who doesn't love a best 11 conversation? Everybody, I don't know. This is just the agreement we sign when we all decide to become soccer fans. You have to love, especially theoretical. Taylor, put that hand down. I swear. Put it down right now. Everybody has to love theoretical lineup building conversations. Okay. I've got my USMNT Canada lineup, and then I'll run through my USMNT Mexico lineup. The Mexico one was significantly more difficult because maybe Mexico's just bad. We'll get to that in a second. USMNT Canada. In goal, I still have Matt Turner. I don't care. Come for me. Do whatever you want. Matt Turner's in my lineup. Gio Reyna's in it too. And everybody's just going to have to deal with that. Matt Turner in goal. Sergiño Dest at right back. Chris Richards and Tim Ream in the middle of the back line. Canada, while they had been defensively solid, or certainly were for a lot of John Herdman's tenure, do it typically out of a back three that I think maximizes those individuals and doesn't really have a standout player that I think is head and shoulders above the rest. So I've got Richards and Ream in the middle of my combined U.S.-Canada back line. Jedi Robinson at left back, my favorite USMNT player. Tyler Adams at defensive midfield. I've got Weston McKennie and Gio Reyna as my two number eight slash kind of number tens. I have Christian Pulisic on one side. And finally, Canada, here's your moment to shine. Alphonso Davies I have on the left wing, and I have Jonathan David, not Falloran Balogun, yes, this hurt, as my number nine. I think that is a very, very good 11. I was tempted by maybe finding a spot for Stefan Eustachio, but I just couldn't do it. Like, I just don't think it's there. I don't think he really unseats a healthy Tyler Adams. Now, quickly, my USMNT Mexico lineup. You can kind of toss a coin between Matt Turner and Guillermo Ochoa. I think I'm still going with Turner, and I'm not even sure that Ochoa is the every game starter for Mexico at this point, but I've got Turner probably still in that spot. Dest, Richards, then Cesar Montes is my other center back partner in Chris Richards. I think there's a few players that could be, but there's no standout secondary U.S. center back, and I think Mexico has a couple options for that spot. Jedi Robinson is my left back. I'm really tempted by Edson Alvarez over Tyler Adams, and I am going to give it to Alvarez. I know I just said a healthy Adams beats Eustachio. Tyler Adams isn't healthy, and I did want to find a way to get Edson Alvarez in this team, even though I would take Adams over Alvarez if both players were probably fully fit. But I'm giving the nod to Edson Alvarez. Weston McKennie and Gio Reyna fell out the midfield. Tim Weah on one side, Christian Pulisic on the other, and I have Santiago Jimenez as my number nine.
Ooh,
Mexican playing for Feyenoord.
Spicy, I didn't expect that. Busy.
I know, Graham took care when talking about the number nine spot in our pre-show chat.
Yeah, I was expecting a fight on this.
I am a bit sensitive, but I don't think you can argue with the production from Jimenez so far, and I think he has not quite gotten yet a consistent fair shake with Mexico. So he is in my USMNT Mexico 11.
Okay. Graham, would you like to analyze that or add your spicy thoughts?
I don't really have much to add that differs in terms of the lineup. As I say, I was expecting a fight on number one, Jonathan David, who at this point I kind of think is a bit of a no-brainer over Balogun. It seems like I am warmer on Balogun over Jimenez than Joe is. Like, I think that's a flip of the coin at the moment. But I think the biggest difference with the Canada lineup is Alphonso Davies. I had him at left back. Jedi Robinson is obviously having the best season of his career, but Alphonso Davies is Alphonso Davies. And I think I can get Pulisic and Davies into the same team on that left side. I think that's the only difference of the two teams. I think other than that, Chucky Lozano, you could maybe say, is on the right wing for the combined US-Mexico team, but I'm still having, or rather on the left wing, but I'm having Pulisic over him. And there's not really anyone that takes Timothy Weah out of the team on the right side. So yeah, I'm struggling with the exception of Edson Alvarez and Jimenez for Mexico.
Joe, I feel like you got around it by being vague. Who is starting at left wing for you?
For which lineup?
For the Canada lineup.
I have Alphonso Davies starting at left wing.
So you move Pulisic to the right?
Yes, I did. Which, he plays there for Milan. He's played there for the US before. It felt fine.
Feels like a betrayal.
I said on this show, I think during World Cup qualifying, there was a real stretch of games for the US where I wanted Christian Pulisic to start on the right side, and Berhalter didn't do it, really. I mean, we saw some in-game switches, we saw a few little tweaks, but Pulisic was dropping so deep so often that it felt like it was disrupting the US's possession play. And I thought, you know, we get Pulisic on the right side, he's right-footed, he's going to stretch the line a bit more, he's going to get to the end line and cut the ball back, and he's fast enough and skillful enough to do that very, very well. And we're seeing that in real time with Milan right now, but we haven't gotten a ton of it with the US, but I think he's a great fit for that spot.
Okay. Taylor, did you overthink this in any way?
Of course. It's my brand. I wouldn't say I overthought. I think a couple things. I have a feeling USMNT supporters overvalue Matt Turner or assume that everyone values Matt Turner as much as we do. Whereas I do think a lot of Canadians might say, like, no, we'll take Maxime Crépeau. Matt Turner's good, but he's not playing for Nottingham Forest. And I think a lot of Mexicans would say, we'll take Guillermo Ochoa. So I didn't have Turner starting for either team. And then the only other one, I think a midfield three of Edson Álvarez, Weston McKennie, and Aceace, Hector Herrera, would be a very fascinating midfield. That's what I went for my combined USA-Mexico midfield. I don't know if it works at all, but I think it would be quite fun. And I also had Jimenez up top with Pulisic and Weah for my combined USA-Mexico team. I had Johan Vasquez starting with Chris Richards. That was the only other difference for me. I think it's interesting that my guess would be with this question, the root of it is that when Bobby Drexler and his friend were doing this, they landed on that maybe just the outright USMNT team beats both of these combined teams. Because it does feel like we have a Mexico team that doesn't have as many stand out head and shoulders above the U.S. in certain positions players at this point. I think they have in iterations past. Maybe this is a lack of familiarity with Liga MX for me. But I do think it's not, there's no clear, there's not nearly as many clear, like, that guy is better than this guy, that guy is better than this guy. I think Canada probably has the two clearest examples of that in Jonathan David and Alfonso Davies, even though, and this led to some consternation amongst my co-hosts, I don't think Alfonso Davies is that big of an upgrade on Jedi Robinson.
What?
Come on. Jedi.
I'm laughing at Graham Taylor, not you, to be clear.
That's fair. So, I mean, I think that is an interesting point that I think, like, Canada has probably the two players that do make the USMNT a little bit better, but I'm also not sure that they make them significantly better. So it is a really interesting question with a lot of permutations and a lot of head scratching for me.
I take that point, Taylor, on Canada. I, at the risk of causing an international incident here, I kind of think Edson Álvarez at this point is quite a significant upgrade on Tyler Adams, not least because Tyler Adams is a bit of an abstract concept right now and can't really get on the football pitch. But Álvarez has been really consistent for a good while now at a good level of European football. Even just if we're being really simplistic about this, Tyler Adams is at Bournemouth. I know this is not how we judge players, but Tyler Adams is at Bournemouth. Edson Álvarez is playing for, like, a good West Ham team in Europe. So I do think he's quite a significant upgrade.
Graham, you're right. That's not how we judge players. But I am sympathetic to parts of that. Like, your point about Álvarez being consistent between his time in the Netherlands, now in the Premier League, it is a good argument. It's one that I'm sympathetic to the point where I kind of do have him in this combined 11. I can't wait to eat my words tomorrow night when Tyler Adams balls out for the U.S. against Jamaica.
I think it's probably also, Graham, because I think it's a valid point. I think it's also the system that the U.S. wants to play, the style that the U.S. wants to play. I don't think of Edson Álvarez as covering a ton of ground and doing that defensive cleanup job. I think he can, but I don't think he does that part as well. I think he does a lot of other things better than Tyler Adams, but that is probably why I weighted Adams more. Though, again, my midfield three for USA-Mexico was Edson Álvarez, Aceace, and Weston McKennie.
Álvarez doesn't cover the amount of ground that Adams does, but I think he still is a physical defensive force who can cover a decent bit of ground. They're similar enough players, but I think Adams does a lot of that stuff better, to your point, Taylor. I just can't imagine living in a world where adding Alfonso Davies, forget Jonathan David, who I do think would make the U.S. better, where adding Alfonso Davies to the U.S. men's national team wouldn't represent a like tournament-altering different reality for the U.S. men's national team. Like, if you put Alfonso Davies into this USMNT 11 at left back, but I would rather have him higher up the field because Jedi Robinson is a very solid option in that left back spot for the U.S., which is huge and was a great development throughout the last World Cup qualifying cycle. Like, if you add Alfonso Davies to this team, I think the betting odds change dramatically. Mm-hmm. I think the discussion around this team changes dramatically. And we're not just talking about, oh, you know, can this team make the quarterfinals or the semifinals? We're talking about this team has a legitimate superstar that they have not had. Someone who has been a regular starter for Bayern Munich, who is injured and so hasn't been playing a ton recently, who is likely going to Real Madrid this summer. Like, can this team do something historic on home soil? Not just historic, oh, let's make it to the quarters or the semis. Like, could this team do it all? Because they don't have the firepower, in my opinion. Yeah, agreed, Ryan. I agree with you. They don't have the firepower right now to make that run. I don't think that's realistic at all. I don't expect the U.S. to make the semis. I would be pleasantly surprised, or maybe not quite surprised, but if they make the quarters, that feels like a very, very solid tournament. Alfonso Davies in this team changes the expectations in a huge way for the U.S.
Joe, I think you may have just answered it with the legitimate superstar point. Does Alphonso Davies, is he the biggest player on the team if you added him to the
Without
USMNT?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so it's a little weird though, right? Because he has to deal with Pulisic. Like, if he just sort of teleported into the U.S. tomorrow, Pulisic has the cachet among American soccer fans that Alphonso Davies just doesn't have because he's not American. He's not as relevant to U.S. soccer fans. So I think that interpersonal dynamics would be a little strange off the bat. But in terms of talent and pedigree, yeah, Davies is the guy by a mile.
All right. Joe, in terms of which is the better of these clone sides, I think we're kind of leaning towards the Canada hybrid being the better of these options. Is the Mexico hybrid better than the straight USMNT side?
By definition, yeah, right? Like if we're putting any players into the lineup over USMNT players, then that means we have to think it's better. I don't think it's dramatically better, and I think there's a reality where, at least in my combined 11, you can replace all the Mexican players that I mentioned with U.S. players, and it's probably just as good, but maybe ever so slightly, yeah. Because I did push them into the 11. Yeah, it has to be.
I think that's the best way to think of it, Joe. If the U.S. has Edson Álvarez and Jimenez in that team, I don't think at World Cup level the needle has moved meaningfully. Whereas I think with Jonathan David and particularly Alphonso Davies, then yeah, I think the needle is moved by those two. So Canada for me.
Excellent stuff. Taylor, concur?
No, USA all the way. USA okay. Wins everything.
Excellent stuff. Bobby, thank you very much for your question. We take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking Jesse Marsh and we're talking about Real Madrid and their spending. Back shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way because businesses that grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show. Welcome back to our listener questions. And this one in particular from Richard Rolson. Would Jesse Marsh hurt or help his future job prospects if he came back to MLS to be a head coach? How long can he remain out of coaching before his career is irreparably harmed? Graham, I saw an interesting article just this morning from John Bruin on The Guardian, the title of which is When Will the US Produce a Soccer Coach Who Will Win Respect in England? And it made something clear that appearance on Monday Night Football, sort of the tactical show that Sky Sports does in the UK, The quote from John Bruin in an article: Monday Night Football has become a regular vehicle for unemployed managers to announce they are ready to work again. And that pretty much is what Jesse Marsh did on his recent appearance. I love the Premier League and I love the power of what the league means globally. And he says, I've kind of been hoping we find some kind of connection back in the Premier League. But if that doesn't come, I have to find out what else is out there and what comes next for me. So he's in the shop window very much, yeah, is Jesse Marsh. Reportedly considering a job with Club Brugge, but maybe has priced himself out of that one, according to reports. But what do we think about his prospects and maybe even the prospect of a return to these here United States?
So I do think his appearance on Monday Night Football was quite significant. Where, and this is, maybe I don't, maybe John doesn't disagree with this point, but they don't just invite anyone on that show. Like, Alan Kirbishley has never had an invite to Monday Night Football. So I do
think... He's a very busy man, Graham, to be fair.
He's a very busy man, yeah. Did you follow the Alan Kirbishley Twitter account that was every job, every manager that was sacked, it would quote tweet the tweet and say, I'm interested or I'm available. It's like a bot. It's one of my favourite Twitter followers. I'm not sure if it's still going. But yeah, Kirbishley's never been on Monday Night Football. So I guess I disagree a little bit with the premise of John Bruin's article in that I think to a certain degree Jesse Marsh has made a breakthrough in English football. I think he is respected. He got that job offer from Southampton after he left Leeds United, which he ended up turning down. I think there will be interest in Jesse Marsh from England. I don't know if that's in the Premier League. Maybe it's a team near the bottom of the Premier League, but certainly top end of the Championship. If we're talking about English football, obviously he's got other options. I definitely think that's achievable for him. But I do think we've got to the point where he probably needs to take something this summer, otherwise he will start to become the forgotten man of English football management. In terms of, with Richard's question, would he harm his job prospects by going to MLS? I presume Richard means his European job prospects. Yes, I think he would. We spoke about this a couple of weeks ago when we had a question about Wilfred Nancy, but the reality of the managerial landscape at this moment in time is that European clubs don't look to MLS for managers. Of course, Jesse Marsh was a bit of an exception, but he goes down the Red Bull pipeline to get to Salzburg. I don't know if that will happen again for him. So when you do get a manager who goes from Europe to MLS, they don't tend to go back the other way. Tata Martino, Bob Bradley. Frank de Boer did it, I guess, but he had the kind of name recognition that Jesse Marsh doesn't have, and it didn't go well for him. But yeah, I think Jesse Marsh's stock, at least in English football, is still intact, and he will get I think he's between Championship and Premier League. He'll get a job at that kind of level.
Excellent. Taylor, your thoughts on this one? I kind of concur with where Graham's at with this.
I kind of do not. I still think there is a stigma around Americans in England, especially American coaches. I think we call it a field. People don't like that. We call it cleats. People don't like that. That seems to have been a recurring thing with Bob Bradley, certainly in his time at Swansea, but then also with Jesse Marsh, that there is a feeling of like, who's this Ted Lasso guy who's calling things different names and has a weird accent? I think there is an element of like, you all just throw the ball. You don't know how to play this sport fully yet. Maybe I'm incorrect, but that has been my genuine impression
an element
from
of that.
Playing with English players.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. And Jesse Marsh, if you go on Twitter while he's on Monday Night Football or whatever, there will have been that element, of course, that undercurrent. But there is a respect for him as well. I think people recognise he is a good coach. And with Bob Bradley and other American coaches, there hasn't been that recognition. That's where I think there is a difference. And it's a silly example, but Monday Night Football is a good case study. Like, Bob Bradley never got on Monday Night Football. Like, Jesse Marsh getting invited to that is a symbol of something.
Can I also say, Taylor, I think it's not just an anti-American bias, it's an anti-non-European bias. Yeah. But I think someone like Ange Postecoglou has helped really break down that wall. I mean, not that long ago, an Australian coach wouldn't have been in the Premier League. Australians, you know, they don't even fully form their words. We've established that at the start of the show. Their toilets flushed the wrong way. So, you know,
they should get that looked at, to be honest. It's long overdue.
Still a member of the Commonwealth, though, right?
Yes, correct.
So, at least they still have that connection. We threw that off a couple hundred years ago. So, there.
Yeah. They've got a good person on their money. Yeah. That's right. They do.
Who? Because I might disagree with you. But, yes, to the purpose of the question, I think, and like Graham, you talked about that Southampton gig, lest we forget, he doesn't take it because they won't give him guarantees of longer than that season. And I think that's the case with maybe Bournemouth. I forget where else he was linked. But I think, like, yes, it hurts his prospects to go back to Major League Soccer if his goal is to manage an elite European team again or be in one of the top leagues in Europe. At the same time, I'm not sure sitting and waiting and doing podcasts is the way that he's going to do that either. So I sort of think if he went to Major League Soccer, had success, built out like a dynasty over a couple years, and then maybe after 2026, if Berhalter steps down or when Berhalter steps down, maybe the U.S. gig is available, maybe he takes that, maybe there's success there, and then he kind of leapsfrog that to a bigger gig. That is a lot of maybes, that is a lot of long-term planning, and a lot of things have to connect along the way, and I think there are as many risks that he could be a failure at MLS, and if that doesn't go well, then his job prospects are extremely limited. So I think he still has opportunity and possibility, but I think, as with most things in our present world, the longer you are out of it, the harder it is to get back into it. And so I do think it's taking a gig this summer and then finding success.
Yeah. Joe, it seems to me the crux of the question is it better to sit on the sidelines and go, I'd like a job, please, or to go and actually do a job in MLS? That's the crux, right?
It is, and I weirdly feel like Jesse Marsh should do the one where he's sitting on his butt and hanging out and doing podcasts, because I just don't see what he has to gain at this point in his career from coaching Major League Soccer. Taylor, I hear what you're saying. If he goes out there and does succeed for 2 or 3 years, like, what does that tell us about Jesse Marsh? He's done this before, is sort of where I come back to. He's already succeeded in Major League Soccer with the New York Red Bulls. He had a ton of success and was legitimately, and I think, like, justifiably, one of the top managers at that point on this side of the Atlantic. And okay, so he comes back and does it again. If he succeeds, great. You know, we didn't really learn anything. And if he fails, well, oh, you know, then all of a sudden the narrative, and I guess by failure, I mean if his team does poorly, right? Because that is, for better or worse, how managers in the public eye get judged. Like, if his team does poorly, it's perceived as another failure after his last two European jobs at a higher level, Leipzig and Leeds, both went poorly. So to me, my read on the Jesse Marsh situation as a pure outsider here is, Taylor, you mentioned after 2026. I kind of think there's a part of Jesse Marsh where he's just sitting around waiting for the Copa America to go poorly for the U.S. and he's just going to step in and say, hey, guys, you know, like, I'm over here. I was in contention last time for the job, and I would like it, please, and thank you. And the U.S. would say, yes, of course, here you go, Jesse.
Was he in contention, though? Didn't they kind of rule him out pretty quickly?
No, he was absolutely in contention for that job. His agent tweeting out that he wasn't going to get the job was the thing that, like, spiraled all of the reporting around Greg Berhalter actually getting confirmed. But my understanding is he was in the running for that job. But, like, I think he's just kind of sitting around, or he's going to wait for the summer to hit, and then you just go and take a nice European job if the USMNT doesn't make a lot of sense. So for me, if I'm Jesse Marsh, I'm waiting at least until the summer. If you're waiting, like, another full year after that, maybe the conversation starts to shift ever so slightly.
Maybe I'm coming at this from just a, like, me-centric perspective, as I tend to do with some of these questions. But I think I didn't want Jesse Marsh as the U.S. coach because I was not convinced that his style of management was going to translate particularly well to the international game, which is not a bold statement by any stretch of the imagination. I think that's a sentiment shared by at least a few people. And so, Joe, I think my thinking was if he were to come back to Major League Soccer and, like, established that he had evolved that style and it wasn't maybe just what we've seen from him in past iterations at Salzburg, at Leipzig, at Leeds. If we saw new wrinkles to his game, new ways of managing, if we saw adjustments that we haven't seen previously, that would make me feel like there is more diversity to the way he coaches. There is more, I guess, variance to what he's doing, and that would make me feel like there is more suitability to a national team gig or a bigger gig.
Could he not do that in a European league, though, or like the top of the championship?
I don't know if he has the license. That's what I keep going back to, is I don't feel like he would get... My assumption as to why he hasn't taken an MLS gig is because he wants a lot of money and a lot of control. That's based on nothing, just genuinely my, like, I'm assuming somebody called
him. And it's just a step backwards for him as well. Like, it's objectively a step in the wrong direction in his career.
I think people will make that step in that direction if there is money and you can make all of the decisions, you can control the front office, have at it. And I think there's probably an element of control that he would like. Similar to Graham Potter when we had a similar question, like, I wonder if he's learned from some of the missteps of the past, Jesse Marsh. And so I just wonder if he wants a little bit more control. I think that's harder to get with a European club and have the kind of patience to not sack him if things aren't going perfectly in 6 months. And I don't think he can afford that either. It's a really tricky situation.
Thank you very much, Richard, for that question. We go now to Aurora Rusto, which is my favorite handle of the day. How is Real Madrid able to afford so many superstar players like Bellingham, Vini Jr., Rodri, etc., 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 and maybe Kylian Mbappe with financial fair play rules, but Barcelona are struggling to keep the players they have right Now, so Graham, my initial thought when I read this question was maybe because they've got the highest revenue of any club in the world. That helps. But looking at the numbers, the ones I found for 2023, the revenue for Real Madrid was 831 million euros in 2023. Barcelona's was 800. So percentage-wise, not a huge difference in terms of turnover between the two sides. So that muddled my thinking a little bit.
Read the same Deloitte report that I did. I also found those same numbers. It is in my notes, but it's not a big part of my answer.
Man City also high up that list, correct? On that Deloitte report. So, you know, big old grain of salt when it comes to revenue and what's being reported.
Yeah. A lot of salt at the Etihad Stadium right now. But in terms of Real Madrid, so the first thing to say is about transfer fees, right? If you look at what the two teams have spent over the last 10 years, Barcelona have spent much more than Real Madrid in terms of their net spend. So yes, Real Madrid have spent big on Bellingham and Hazard, and Tchouaméni was all in that 10-year spell, but they have also raised a lot of money through some big sales players that have left the club. So Angel Di Maria, Casemiro, Rafael Varane, basically whoever Man United fancy ruining the career of next, essentially. So Barcelona's net spend for the last 10 years is roughly $600 million, whereas Real Madrid's is half that. Also, Real Madrid sell a lot of academy graduates, so that goes down as pure profit on the balance sheet. You mentioned revenue, Ryan, not a huge amount of difference there, but 30 million euros, I guess that counts for something. Then you have the wage bills. So this season, Real Madrid are spending more on wages than Barcelona. But a few years ago, Barcelona's wage bill was completely out of control. In the 2021 season, they spent more on wages than any other club in the world. Their wages to revenue ratio was something, I think, like 88%. They were spending over 500 million euros a season on wages, and Real Madrid were over 100 million a season lower than that. So that's another consideration to make. The thing with Mbappe, in terms of how they'll be able to sign him, the reporting at the moment is he is apparently going to take a pay cut to join Real Madrid. That contract will be full of bonuses, but his base contract will be quite significantly lower than it is at PSG. But on top of this, Real Madrid are expecting their revenue to balloon over the next few years because of the opening, or the full opening, of the new Bernabeu as this sort of super stadium with NFL games and concerts. I think Taylor Swift, the Eras Tour, is making a stop off at the Bernabeu this summer.
They are reorganising fixtures for it, Graham, indeed.
Exactly. Tennis tournaments, I think, are going to happen. Did I maybe see that an NBA game is going to happen at the Bernabeu sometime soon? So they've got that going as well. Meanwhile, Barcelona don't have a stadium right now. It's a pile of rubble. So there are some differences between the two that allow Real Madrid to spend this sort of money.
So what I'm hearing, Graham, is one club is much better run than the other one, is the shorthand
answer. That
could
be it. That's the TLDR, yes. Could have saved myself some time there.
Goodness me. Joe or Taylor, anything to add here? I think that was pretty comprehensive.
I've got one for you. I think Graham may have touched on this, but Graham ran through a lot of stuff I had, so I'm just going to dig deeper into one thing. Just the age of the people that they're pursuing, I think, is a big factor here. Graham, did you get into this much?
No, don't
cool.
think so.
Wanted to make sure. I think when you talk about Madrid signings, the Galactico signings, you're talking about guys who are, what, like 24, 25, 26 in that era? You're talking about people who are in their prime, who are basically commanding a prime salary. Maybe some of those guys end up getting sold on afterwards, but I think rarely for as much money as was spent to bring them in. Looking at somebody like maybe Eden Hazard as a prime example of that. Lately, like when you talk about Rodrigo, to the people listed in this question, maybe Bellingham aside, but Rodrigo, they sign when he's 17. He moves when he's 18. The same thing for Vinicius Jr. Arda Güler is 19 now. I think they signed him when he's 18. And so it does feel like there has been a dedicated move towards spending fairly large amounts of money to bring in young players at a very young age, when I think historically they would have maybe let that player make a move or make another move, and then they're signing them at 23 for four times what they spent on them. So somebody like Vinicius, when they bring him in, is what, like 30 million, 45 million, I think, euros?
Yeah.
And I think if he makes one move to Europe, scores a bunch of goals, and then goes to Madrid, he's a 90 million euro player right there. And so I do think the way they've kind of shifted their recruitment has been pretty fascinating. And then augmenting that with, as Graham said, selling on academy players, which sometimes is Zinedine Zidane's son for a couple million euros, but also is somebody like Achraf Hakimi, who I kind of forgot came through their academy, but then they end up selling him on for 40 or 50 or whatever
Morata
it was.
As well. I think they got like 60 million for Morata when they sold him to Chelsea.
And so it does seem like they have done a better job of getting value out of academy players coming through to the first team, but also academy players selling them on. Martin Odegaard would be another example of that. So it seems like the way they've shifted towards signing young players that have then hit, pretty much all of them have hit in my mind, makes a pretty big difference in the way they're able to balance their books.
And as a sort of a sub point to all this, you even just look at the transfer expenditure. And there was that disastrous window that Madrid had in what would that be, 1920, with Eden Hazard and Luka Jovic, and they burn a whole bunch of money on basically nothing.
Negative 200 million, yeah.
Yeah, it's not great. But then basically since then, they've done a really, really good job. They have either broken even or come out ahead in terms of their transfer expenditure, at least according to reports and what we can find online. They've done an excellent job of finding, you know, Taylor, to your point, younger players who don't tend to cost as much, although there is the potential tax that's on a lot of these guys. But generally speaking, don't cost as much. And Madrid have done a good job of offloading some players who are either, you know, a little surplus to requirements, or in Casemiro's case, going to Manchester United, where they get a whole bucket load of money, like getting good value for a player on the decline of his career. Not that I think that was the worst decision by Manchester United at the time, although there were issues in that move from a Man United perspective. Like, they've just done things, and Ryan, you kind of summarized it. Like, they've just done a lot of things really, really well, which is, to me, it feels a little strange, right? Because my soccer brain says Barcelona sort of have been the model club when it comes to having this philosophy from the first team down to the academy that gives you a very clear idea of who you want to go and recruit and bring into the team. They're still producing nice young players, are going out and finding them for cheap before they really hit, in Pedri's case. But like, it's Real Madrid who have done a lot, the Vibes Club, who have done a lot of these things so, so well when it comes to recruitment, where they've hit on almost everybody in recent transfer windows, selling at the right time, continuing to evolve the squad, and doing all of that while trying to renovate a stadium and keeping Kylian Mbappe as the apple of Florentino Perez's eye. And that's going to happen. They've left room for him. They have the ability to go out and sign him. And it's really, really sharp business.
It is, yeah. Ultimately, Joe, I think you've got a scenario where both big teams are spending like €1 billion renovating their stadiums. One has adapted its expenditure for players. One hasn't.
Yep.
Is essentially why 100%. We're in this mess.
And it's all this, I hope, should speak ill of Barcelona. Like, the fact that they have fumbled the bag so hard, generally being dealt the same hand as Real Madrid. You mentioned the stadium changes, Ryan. Like, they play in the same league. They are the two big dogs. They're the teams that will always be compared to each other. Barcelona have fumbled the bag so hard when it comes to player recruitment, when it comes to manager recruitment in a lot of respects, when it comes to basically every single decision that they've made as a club. And Real Madrid haven't been perfect, mind you. Again, I point back to that transfer window with Eden Hazard and Luka Jovic. And there have been other flops along the way, but by and large, like, there is no comparison between the effective operations of the two Spanish giants right now.
Has anyone seen the Nou Camp recently? Oh, it makes me nervous. It makes me really nervous.
Is there
anything
there?
They basically demolished the whole thing. There's barely anything there. With the Bernabeu, they kept like the majority of the stadium and built a frame around it and a new top tier and a roof. The Nou Camp is just a pile of rubble, and apparently it's some like dodgy company with financial issues that's doing the construction work. Oh man, I hope they haven't just demolished the Nou Camp and never returned.
From what I understand, it's easier to build new than to renovate. So maybe they're just trying to be cost efficient.
If you have money, I think
there is
it's
that,
easier to do that.
There is that thing. There is that aspect of things.
There's the opportunity cost of not being able to play in your stadium for longer, though, I suppose, which Real Madrid haven't had necessarily. And they use their own facility when they were.
That's true. They played at their reserve stadium, right? Yeah, also, I thought it was interesting, both clubs turning a profit on the women's side. I think Barca number one in that category, Madrid up there as well. But given that Madrid didn't have a women's team like 2 years ago, that's no small feat. The managerial point, Joe, that you mentioned, very last thing for me. It is strange how Madrid have sort of gotten lucky in certain ways with the managers they've had, but that has led, in my mind, to more stability. But kind of forgot that there was a Carlo Ancelotti period after Jose Mourinho.
Yep.
Then it's Rafa Benitez, a move we all knew would work. Then it's Zinedine Zidane. That goes well. Then it's Lopetegui. That goes even worse than Rafa Benitez. Then it's Santiago Solari. Then it's Zidane. Then it's Carlo Ancelotti again. And so there have been moments of instability in there, but there's also been a lot of stability and a lot of success. Whereas with Barca, they've had some successes, but then they've had some pretty big misses and some pretty big chaos. So I do think on the managerial side, when there is stability in that department, I feel like it's easier to bring in players, get them bedded into the team, but also recruit players who feel like, I know what I'm buying into, and I'm not seeing somebody being forced out the door while I'm brought in simultaneously.
Real Madrid, they course correct pretty quickly, right? When something bad happens, or when there's a bad summer window, or they make a bad managerial appointment, they do correct things pretty quickly. So the Lopetegui-Solari season was a bit of a mess, but then it ends with Zidane coming in. And when does he win the Champions League that season? I think he does. So even that season ends with a European title. Whereas Barcelona, their mistakes seem to last like years and years.
And now they've just got a pile of rubble with a Spotify sign on it. That's what they've got to show for their workings. Thank you very much, Aurora, for that question. An excellent one it was. We go now to Jonathan Hugel, who says, many players are known for one particular aspect of their game, such as James Ward-Prowse's free kicks, Arjen Robben's drifting in from the right and having a shot, etc. and so on. Are there any players who have an undervalued aspect of their game because they're viewed as a one-trick pony? Love and it. Additionally, asked Jonathan, are there any true one-trick ponies playing at the highest level in
Messi.
Europe?
On Europe, right. Okay, just MLS.
Which trick are we referring to here, Graham?
Destroy defenders and score. It's a pretty good trick to have.
Being really good at soccer trick. Yeah
being the best player in the world. Yeah. This is one trick. Yeah.
Taylor, in terms of the question about players with undervalued aspects of their games because they might be viewed as a one-trick pony, it's tricky because it's actually really hard to think of genuine one-trick ponies in the modern game. Is the last bastion of that, like the big man who's good with his feet?
Perhaps so there we go. This, a bit of like disclaimer for a moment. With this question, this is one I keep a notebook, as you all know. I occasionally write questions in the back of it to like pay attention to as time goes on, because this is one where I suspect there are a lot more answers than have occurred to me than I have on my list, and I feel like they will sort of come to me over time, so it's fun to think about as I watch more games. The only two that really jumped out to me, and I think this is even being generous with the one-trick pony thing, is basically players that we had or people have an idea of who they are and value them in sort of just one way, even if they have a variety of skill sets. So Fellaini would be one of those. Marouane Fellaini, I think people think is like tall, wins stuff in the air, when in reality, good control, good ball control, but also a really good engine. That's a very underrated aspect of his game. He would just run and run and run. And also leadership, spirit, never really gave up, would always fight for things, would always be the person going into challenges in the 90-plus minute. So I think of him as one where everybody kind of wrote him off because of his height and because of the fro. And maybe, I think it's changed over time, but Sergio Busquets for a little while was that, where it's like, yeah, it's simplicity. He passes the ball. He takes one touch. He doesn't really do much else. He can't really run. He's not particularly fast. But I think over time, there was a greater appreciation for his vision, for his processing, for impacting the game by slowing up or speeding down the tempo. So I think of those two as players that, as maybe people kind of wrote off because they thought they knew who they were on the surface, when in reality there was more going on.
Very good. Joe, anything to add here?
Yeah, I have both players who are often viewed as one-trick ponies and who aren't, and some that I think are true one-trick ponies still in the modern game who are playing at the highest level. Okay. Kylian Mbappe is my first player who is not a one-trick pony, but I think often gets labeled as one. He is viewed for his speed, and he is an incredible athlete. Regardless of sport, he is a phenomenal athlete. He's also just so technical. You watch this guy dribble, you watch what he can do on the ball. I do not think that is the best part of his game. I think it is athleticism first, technical ability second. But they are married in this really beautifully effective way that has led him to be one of the greatest soccer players on the planet for several years now. I was I posted this on social media yesterday. I was up snowboarding in Flagstaff yesterday, and we were in line just sort of talking about soccer along the way. And I felt like David Goss, to be clear. We were in line talking about soccer, and somehow like Kylian Mbappe came up, and there was a kid behind me who was like, yeah, I wonder who's faster, Kylian Mbappe or Thierry Henry. And I just thought that was funny that was the first thing that came to his mind, especially in this question. He is fast, Mbappe, but that's not the whole thing for Kylian Mbappe. The other one, Taylor, that I had down on my list as not a one-trick pony.
Is that even a question? By the way, isn't Mbappe?
I didn't think so. I sort of politely paid it off as like, oh, well, we'll never find out because Henri's old now, basically, is there what I said. But I think Mbappe would win that one, and I'm not sure how close it is.
Me too.
But I guess we'll never know for sure unless somebody can do a cool like overlay film thing that I don't know how to do. Rodri is on my list as well. Taylor, you mentioned Busquets. These like generally these deep-lying, like possession mover kind of players who can break lines, They do that. But as the last line of defense in midfield, a little weird there of a sentence, as that last player at the base of midfield, your job is not just to move the ball, although it is that. Your job is also to be the one shielding the back line. Like Rodri and Busquets, the elite number sixes in the possession systems, they're not like really straight line speed players, but their reaction time, their ability to see the game and to step in, whether that's to win the ball or to make a tactical foul, to be honest, two players that played under Pep Guardiola, that's a key point of emphasis in their counter-pressing moments. You have to be elite with that first step, with your acceleration, with your timing, all that stuff. So those players, in my mind, yes, they have a dominant skill, but very much not one-trick ponies. One-trick pony that I want to see if I can get this one past the group. Erling Haaland. He is like real close to a one-trick pony. Is he not? It's not like he's incapable on the ball.
What's the trick? Scoring.
The trick is being the best athlete on the field at any given time and faster than you at any given time. Like, he's just so good at that trick that nothing else matters. Like, he can do all that stuff, and he doesn't need to be able to drop in and link play. He doesn't need to do any of that stuff. He can go out there and score 30 goals a season just by being a vroom vroom, like, roadrunner out there, and it is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, Joe, that's a great point. I was actually going to bring up Haaland to the group because for his positive traits, versatility is probably not one of them, right?
Not at all. Not in my mind, anyway.
But are we counting things like intelligence and within the box and knowing, because that's not luck that he's in positions. That's reading of the game
I think,
and situation.
Grim, that's a fair point, right? And any part of being a good number nine is being able to find that space. But I also just don't think that's unique. I guess maybe when I think about all these skills, I was thinking most about physical or on-ball attributes or just like pure athleticism or something along those lines. Yeah, I guess you could boil it down to their intelligence and all that stuff, and I kind of mentioned that with the number sixes. I think if you do that, though, there probably isn't a single professional player who would fit into this category.
That's where I struggle with this one. I really struggle to come up with names.
The only thing with Haaland for me is when he has his first game in the Premier League and like scores, I don't know, like 12 goals in the first game. I remember all the City players being like, he's got a way to go until he understands how to play our system. And there was a sort of like, I think you're right, Haaland, especially when he goes to City, has a like, he is more of that like flat track bully, one trick pony. I think he probably has developed aspects of his game. Joe, I still take your point that like he has improved such that he fits with what Pep wants and does what Pep wants. I think still, because of the physical abilities, he doesn't have to improve that much because he can still be a difference maker on his own.
Can I make the argument for another Manchester City player? So we've mentioned Haaland, we've mentioned Rodri. I think the Rodri argument is pretty sound. Can I mention Kyle Walker? Dumb Kyle Walker, to clarify.
Thank you.
Just because his pace is such a dominant part of his game that I don't think he's anywhere near Manchester City or that level of football without it. He's not really a great crosser, especially when you consider him to someone like Kieran Trippier or certainly Alexander Arnold, but that's maybe a bit of an unfair comparison to compare him to like a generational crosser. But even Trippier or Rhys James is a better crosser than Kyle Walker. I wouldn't even say that Kyle Walker is that strong in defensive engagements. Like, we've seen Raheem Sterling absolutely cook him this season by cutting inside, but that speed that he's got just covers for so much, and he's perfect for Manchester City. He's in the perfect team to make use of that with their high line, and he's the safety net. So again, one-trick pony is such a reductive way to think of a player, but Kyle Walker, when I was thinking of Man City, was the one that jumped to the top of the list.
That is the one, Graham, that like, In looking at players who are maybe actually one-trick ponies, which again feels very reductive, feels very unfair, what I landed on was basically players that were fast from the jump and sort of relied on that speed. It's not dissimilar from a 12-year-old who's the biggest and tallest kid on the field just being like, oh, I'm the biggest, tallest kid. I can score goals and do whatever I want. And then everybody catches up to them in size and suddenly they haven't developed those other skills. I think players that were so fully reliant on their speed that maybe they didn't develop other aspects of their game would be on that list for me. So somebody like maybe Aaron Lennon, who for a period of time felt like he was going to be the next like big thing, the next like world beater, I wouldn't put him in that list. And maybe even Theo Walcott was a player that I thought was going to be that next level player, and I'm not sure ever fully got there. So I think of players as who are like very, very, very speedy and then didn't evolve their game from there.
I agree that the term is reductive. Will anyone give me Hakan Çalhanoğlu for shots from 50 yards that are really good?
Is that the same Hakan Çalhanoğlu this season we have praised for being like one of the best deep line playmakers in Europe?
That one. You give me it?
I think the answer is no.
Two trick pony.
Well, two-trick pony. Maybe. That's still a good pony. Will anyone give me Brendan Aaronson?
Which What's the?
I don't know if the mic picked up my angry sigh. It was an angry sigh there.
Probably not. I'm taking that as a maybe, but maybe not. I think Aaron's probably fits in that category.
I think it's fair.
No, what's his one trick annoying you?
Intensity.
Yeah, what Taylor said, but also maybe what Graham said. So maybe that's two tricks.
I think what I said is why what Graham said is true. Yes.
I had one other nomination for a two-trick pony, Timo Werner, because he could miss and be offside.
I knew you were going to bring up Timo Werner.
Had to be in there.
Ain't
this
I
is
stinker.
The full bingo card. Joe bring up Brendan Aaronson and you bring up Timo Werner.
There we go. Jonathan, thank you very much for that question. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking Europa League final madness. And we're talking about iconic moments defined by a single phrase in the game. Back shortly.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our listener questions. Zach Clark has been in touch and says, if Liverpool and Leverkusen, i.e. Klopp and Alonso, were to meet in the Europa League final, do you think that could outshine this year's Champions League final? Oh, Joe, you getting are the shoulders moving again for that one? The prospect of Liverpool versus Leverkusen in the Europa League final. I mean, if we think as a comparison, what's a dream Champions League final? Is it a PSG Real Madrid?
No, it's a classical. Surely it's a classical. I mean, maybe that's looking beyond footballing reasons, but the way the draw is set up, it's surely Real Madrid Barcelona.
Boo!
Really?
I say boo to
Why?
That. I think, by the way, I will say my answer is yes to this question. I think final, Liverpool-Leverkusen, outshines the Champions League final. So there you go.
Oh, wow.
I think there's so many captivating things for both teams in there, including the managers, whereas with Barca and Real Madrid, I am probably alone here. I will note that. But for me, it's just like, it's Barca. They're in free fall. I don't know if they're on fire or good. Xavi's leaving. I don't know what to make of them. Madrid have been sort of comprehensively good for so long. It's almost not fun. Like, I feel like the Real Madrid Man City would be the ultimate final of that, of like two teams that are both very good that I don't know. I feel like that would just be like a 1-0 final after extra time or something. I feel like Liverpool Leverkusen could go any number of ways and give us like potentially a 3-2 scoreline in a European final. That would be fun.
So I went the other way and looked at, rather than the best Champions League final, what I thought the worst possible Champions League final could be. Mm. And if I thought the Leverkusen-Liverpool Europa League potential final would outshine that. And the worst one that I could think of for the Champions League is Dortmund-Arsenal. There are other arguments you could have. You get a Barcelona in the final against a non-Real Madrid team because then you lose the narrative boost that would justify Barcelona being there in the first place. I think Dortmund-Arsenal would be an extremely underwhelming Champions League final that has 0% chance of happening. Even then, I am just so not sure that a Europa League final of any two teams can outshine a Champions League final. I don't know if this is right or wrong, and this is 100% just my bias and perspective. Is that even possible? Like, can we even do this, even with the best possible Europa League final? And that would be a very good and fun game that we would no doubt talk about on this show. And we don't always and don't tend to go very deep into the Europa League. And we don't even tend to talk a ton about the final because it's the Europa League. It's the teams that weren't good enough to make the Champions League. The teams that some of them dropped from the Champions League to the Europa League already. It feels wrong to me. I just can't do it, even though it would narratively be a fantastic Europa League final.
So as an example to answer your question, or to try and answer your question, Joe, could it ever happen? I would go back to 2019, right? Where we had a heavyweight Europa League final between Chelsea and Arsenal. And from memory, this isn't my research, 2019 Champions League final is Liverpool against Spurs in Madrid, I think. So you could argue that Chelsea and Arsenal, in terms of the size of the club, size of the
support...
In Azerbaijan,
I think, Graham, as well.
It was in Baku, yeah, that's right. There was a lot of empty seats at that game.
Amazing.
Do we feel that the Chelsea-Arsenal Europa League final outshone the Champions League final that year? My answer is no. The Champions League final was still a bigger deal. So that's the best real-world example that I can think of where there wasn't much difference in terms of the quality and the size of the two clubs, or the four clubs involved.
I think it's a great example. Where I sort of am sympathetic, Taylor, to what you're talking about is I think Liverpool-Leverkusen is so much better than that Arsenal-Chelsea final would have been. Like, it is such a good game. It would be tons of fun. Leverkusen are one of the stories of the soccer world right now and have been for quite some time this season. And Liverpool are an excellent team. And you have the crossover with all of the interest in Xabi Alonso coming from both sides. It would be a lovely game, both in terms of the on-field tactical setups, the performances,
Stop
the
there,
stars,
Joe.
All that stuff.
Stop here now.
And I'm not going to. And okay. It would be a great game narratively. I just think it is at such a disadvantage by being the Europa League. And that, frankly, is how it should be.
Well, it depends what we mean by outshone, right? Are we talking about football in a football sense? Could the Europa League final outshine the Champions League? Yes, of course it could, because Leverkusen are the best team in Germany and Liverpool are possibly the second best team, or certainly in that upper echelon of the English teams in the Premier League right now. And we're not guaranteed that level of quality in the Champions League. The draw is actually quite lopsided in terms of quality in the Champions League. So we've got Arsenal and Bayern Munich and Real Madrid and Man City on one half of the draw. Then we've got Atletico, Madrid and Dortmund, and PSG and Barcelona. They're the four teams on the other side of the draw. So one of those last four teams is going to make the final. And all of those four teams, Atleti, Dortmund, PSG, Barca, have flaws. So there's no guarantee that in a football sense it will be a better final than the Europa League. But in terms of spectacle and just the fact that is the Europa League final held on a Wednesday still, and the Champions League final is still on a Saturday, which I think plays a part in viewership and how many people are watching that game. Europa League does have a better anthem. It's an absolute banger. It's better than the Champions League anthem. Come at me.
Sing
That's
it
a hot for
take.
That opinion.
Sing it.
Sing it. Do you want me to do that? Keep that for the Patreon.
I want you to do
that.
Patreon.
Keep that for Patreon. The
Patreon. Oh, fine.
Joe can play it on the piano and I'll sing along. There's no words. But yeah, I struggle with the kind of non-footballing factors, the intangibles, to think it will outshine the Champions League final.
All right, fair enough. Thank you very much, Zach Clark, for that question. One more for this episode from Peter Jordan, who says, in American football, there are numerous examples where a simple phrase is forever identified with an iconic moment, such as the immaculate reception, clever, and the catch. Other than the hand of God, can you think of examples of similar phrases identified with iconic moments in soccer history? I could think of quite a lot, actually, when I put my head to this one. I think a lot of them are around controversial or memorable incidents. So in Italian soccer, Calciopoli, we would all know that what that refers to in terms of Juventus' relegation and the naughtiness of several clubs. The Maracanazo, I would say, is quite popular in terms of the 1950 World Cup. And also, they have a version of that for the Brazil-Germany game in 2014 as well. Even something like the Battle of Old Trafford in 2003.
That's on my list.
That's a big one, right? That most ingrained soccer fans will know that one.
I don't know what that is.
It's Man United Arsenal, they threw pizza at each other.
Yeah.
And Martin Keown like assaulted Van Nistelrooy.
Yeah. I was liking it. I liked the pizza part more than the assault part, but yeah.
It was a very enjoyably violent spectacle, should we say, Joe.
But are any of those moments? This is what I struggled with. I hear you, Ryan. I have a ton of things like that.
Yeah.
But to the point of the question, I don't know if there are as many phrases for like a moment, a thing that stands out, a shot, a goal. And I think maybe that's because soccer doesn't really lend itself towards like set plays, except for set pieces. I have a couple, but I think that's maybe the difference.
If you want moments, Taylor, how about some of these? These aren't, there's certain words which will evoke certain moments. Aguero, right?
That evokes. That's just his name, though.
No, but said like Aguero. That's a particular moment, right? In a moment in time.
Yeah, haunted Martin Tyler.
If I was to say Graham, the headbutt, what would you think of?
Well, that's Zidane on Materazzi, isn't it?
If I was to say the scorpion kick, maybe this is English specific.
Rene Higuita. That's
Rene Higuita, right? That's one. Joe, if I was to say the horse collar.
Surely that has not cracked this other esteemed list, but amongst the TSS force I'm here, yes, that does bring back Chiellini versus Bukayo Saka.
The Flying Dutchman.
Yeah, Van Persie. I've got one more suggestion. The banana free kick.
Yeah,
that was one when I was a kid.
Roberto Carlos and Le Tournoi in 1997. Graham, excellent stuff. That's ingrained into my brain. That one. And Taylor, in terms of names of players as well, it's not a moment, but like, I think there's a lot of nicknames out there which kind of fall into Peter's category here. The Divine Ponytail, the White Feather. A lot of them are Italian. Mm. That was Ravinelli, for example.
Wazza. Now we're just going through nicknames. These aren't moments.
So I think this is a really interesting question, because I think the answer is no, there are not as many, in my opinion, because I don't think we do break soccer down like that. So I don't it's harder to find those like specific moments. I honestly think two of them are Maradona. One is the hand of God, and then the other, what's the name for his goal against England where he dribbles everybody?
Pure awesomeness makes Ryan shudder.
Glorious.
But I think there's like the most beautiful goal or something like that is what it's called. The only other one that I feel like maybe qualifies, and even this I had to Google to see what people refer to it as, is I guess you could go with Le Hand of God, or I've seen it pejoratively called Le Hand of Frog, but Thierry Henry handball is probably the other one. So right to your point, those sort of like punitive incidents, I had the headbutt on there as well for sure.
I think there are moments that are talked about in the same way. It just tends to be we're a bit more literal with how we describe them. Like, for example, everyone knows the Zidane volley. Like, everyone knows, but it's not given like a whimsical kind of name in the way that other sports are. Or like a Scotland, I was talking with a friend about the Scotland team in the last Euros, and we talked about the Gilmore game. Like, everyone knows what the Gilmore game is, but it's very literal.
It's on Netflix,
right?
It's not isn't very, it?
Yeah, there's 8 seasons of it. But you know, do you get what I mean? Like, it's a bit more literal when we talk about these moments.
Yeah, I suppose so. Like, even like the Beckham halfway line kick, there's moments where there's not a neat little name for them, I suppose. There's moments we all know, but they're not neatly defined, like the catch. What is the catch, by the way, from NFL?
It was Joe a 49ers. Yeah, it was a 49ers moment from maybe the 80s or something along those
Did
lines.
Did he catch a ball in some other, and no one's ever caught one since? Is that what it was?
It's just, I think it's just for the drive itself and the significance of the moment combined with like the way it's thrown on a rope and the catch in the back of the end.
No, Ryan, you were right. Joe Montana threw the ball to himself and then they stopped playing football forever and no one's ever catched the ball since.
I thought so.
I do also think part of this is also that there's just so much soccer. Whereas with the NFL, with a lot of American sports, it's you have the season, you have the playoffs, and then it's done for a while. You don't have 400 other leagues competing at the same time. So I think if we said like the shot from halfway, we would assume it was Beckham that would come to mind, but there are so many other moments of that. Like the one that maybe more recently could become one is the Kellen Acosta goal from this past weekend. Like the wind goal, I feel like could become a thing because
we have a chance to coin
this. So ridiculous.
We have a chance to do something really, really cool. The Windy City goal, is that lame? That feels lame.
I was expecting something. You gave that such a big
I didn't have the
joke.
Answer. I was just saying we have a chance to do something.
Who's the
cool.
God of wind? I'm looking this up.
Oh, that's cool.
The Windy Chicago.
Nope. That's worse than mine, actually. Impressively enough.
All right. That's not canon. Fine.
Right, while Taylor's that. Googling the God
the
of wind.
The Zephyrus strike.
Yes, that's the one.
The increment injury time stunner. No, I like that. Go on. Sorry, Jeff.
All right, I regret opening this can of worms. My couple of nominations, I think the first one probably doesn't fit the exact same template that Peter's provided in the question, but Disgrace at Gijón is on my list. It sort of fits with your initial salvo, Ryan, like all these events or games or whatever in history, 1982 World Cup, West Germany, Austria, fix the game essentially so that they can both go through. And then the other one, in line with the Aguero call, go, go, USA. I don't think it has nearly the pull of the Aguero call, but Ian Dark's goal call after Landon Donovan scores the winner against Algeria in the 2010 World Cup, that would have been. That is an iconic moment that sort of fits maybe a bit more with the immaculate reception or the catch, but it is hard to come up with equals here to the NFL.
Yeah.
The Snow Classico. That's one, isn't it? Like, that's the US-Costa Rica game from 10 years ago in Colorado.
Oh, the one we're missing is the immaculate toothbrush. The guy brushing his teeth behind the Chelsea bench that time.
I've never heard of this before.
Oh, Joe. Joe, you need to get on YouTube, son. That's what you need to do. Yeah, excellent. Peter, thank you very much indeed for that question. That wraps up our listener questions for another day. Patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow to support us if you choose to do so. Thank you very much to everyone who does currently. But for now, Taylor Rockwell, your A's to my Q's were spot on. Thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
Graham Rutherford, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey. I secretly liked the windy Chicago. We can use that between us.
Thanks, secret code. Joe Lowry, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan. This was fun.
Listener, thank you the mostest for joining us. We'll be back on the feed very shortly, but for now, bye.